reduces awareness and interest. Psychiatrists who support the drug claim it actually cures the patient by altering or repairing bad brain chemistry. But critics, who greatly outnumber supporters, cite numerous studies that show the drug to produce a long, frightening list of side effects. Sedation, drowsiness, lethargy, poor concentration, nightmares, emotional difficulties, depression, despair, lack of spontaneous interest in the surroundings, a blunting or dulling of the patient's awareness and motor control. Thorazine is toxic to most brain functions and disrupts nearly all of them. Its harshest critics have called it nothing more than a chemical lobotomy. They claim that the only real purpose of Thorazine is to save money for mental institutions and prisons and to make patients and inmates more manageable. Ron's Thorazine was doled out by his jailers, sometimes with instructions from his lawyer. Often, though, there was no supervision. He got a pill when he got too loud. Even though Dennis Fritz had remained in Ada for 4 years after the murder, he was considered an escape risk. Like Ron's, his bail was exorbitant and out of the question. Like all defendants, they were presumed to be innocent, but nonetheless kept in jail so they wouldn't flee or be loose on the streets killing others. Presumed innocent, but they would wait almost a year until they went to trial. A few days after Dennis arrived at the jail, a man by the name of Mike Tenney suddenly appeared outside his cell. Fat and balding and not well-spoken, Tenney nonetheless had a big smile and a friendly manner, and he treated Dennis like an old friend. And he desperately wanted to talk about the Carter murder. Dennis had been around Ada long enough to know the jail was a cesspool of snitches, liars, and cutthroats, and he knew that any conversation with anyone could very well be repeated in a courtroom in a version slanted sharply against the person on trial. Every inmate, guard, cop, trustee, janitor, cook, everyone was a potential snitch, anxious to pick up details and then retail the information to cops. Tenney said he was new to the place and claimed to be a jailer, but in fact, he was not yet on the county's payroll. Though unsolicited, and certainly not based on knowledge or experience, Tenney had plenty of advice for Dennis. In his opinion, Dennis was in deep trouble, staring at an execution, and the best way to save his skin was to come clean, confess, cut a deal with Peterson over at the DA's office, and give up the dirt on Ron Williamson. Peterson would be fair? Dennis just listened. Tenney wouldn't go away. He returned every day, shaking his head gravely at Dennis's predicament, babbling on about the system and how he thought it operated, giving sage advice that was absolutely free. Dennis just listened. A preliminary hearing was scheduled for July 20th, before Judge John David Miller. Like in most jurisdictions, preliminaries were crucial in Oklahoma because the state was required to play its hand, to show the court and everyone else who its witnesses would be and what they would say. The challenge for a prosecutor at a preliminary was to show just enough evidence to convince the judge that there were reasonable grounds that the defendant was guilty, while not yet revealing everything to the defense. It was gamesmanship, with a bit of risk. Normally, though, a prosecutor had little to worry about. Local judges find it hard to get reelected if they dismiss criminal charges. But with such flimsy evidence against both Fritz and Williamson, Bill Peterson had to push hard at the preliminary. He had so little to offer that he could certainly hold nothing back, and the local newspaper would be there, anxious to report every word. 3 months after its publication, The Dreams of Ada was still being hotly debated around town. The preliminary hearing would be Peterson's first performance in a major trial since the book came out. A nice crowd gathered in the courtroom. Dennis Fritz's mother was there, as were Annette Hudson and Renee Simmons. Peggy Stillwell, Charlie Carter, and their two daughters arrived early. The regulars, board lawyers, local gossips, idle clerks, retirees with nothing to do, waited for their first good look at the two murderers. The trial was months away, but the live testimony was about to be heard. Before the hearing, and just for the sheer fun of it, the Ada police informed Ron that Dennis Fritz had finally made a full confession that implicated both of them in the rape and murder. The shocking news sent Ron off the deep end. Dennis was sitting quietly with Greg Saunders at the defense table, looking over some documents, waiting for the hearing to begin. Ron was sitting nearby, still handcuffed and shackled and glaring at Fritz as if he wanted to choke him. Suddenly and without warning, Ron bolted out of his chair and began screaming at Fritz, who was just a few feet away. A table went flying through the air and landed on Barney's assistant, Linda. Dennis jumped up quickly and moved near the witness stand as the guards tackled Ron.
"Dennis, you no-good, lousy son of a bitch!" he screamed. "We're gonna settle this right now!"
His deep, husky voice boomed around the courtroom. Barney got hit and fell out of his chair. The guards grabbed Ron, tackled him, and tried to subdue him. He was kicking and thrashing about like a madman, and the guards had their hands full. Dennis, Greg Saunders, and the court personnel quickly backed away and gawked in disbelief at the sight of the pileup in the middle of the courtroom. It took several minutes to subdue Ron, who was bigger than any of his guards. As they dragged him away, Ron spewed a vile stream of vulgarities and threats at Fritz. When the dust settled, the tables and chairs were rearranged, and everyone took a deep breath. Barney didn't see the brawl, but he knew he'd been in the middle of it. He rose and said, "I want the record to show that I am now making an application to withdraw. That boy won't cooperate with me at all. If he was paying me, I wouldn't be here. I can't represent him, Judge. I just can't do it. I don't know who's going to, but I can't. And if I can't get relief here, I'm going to see if I can't get it from the Court of Criminal Appeals. I'm not going to put up with this. I'm too damned old for it, Judge. I don't want anything to do with him, under any circumstances. I have no idea about his guilt. That has nothing to do with it. But I'm not going to put up with this. The next thing you know, he'll be thumping on me, and when he does, he's in bad trouble. And I'll probably be in worse trouble." To which Judge Miller quickly replied, "Counsel's motion will be overruled." It was heartbreaking for Annette and Renee to watch their brother act like a madman and to see him dragged around in chains. He was sick and needed help. A long stint in an institution with good doctors who could get him well. How could the state of Oklahoma put him on trial when he was so obviously sick? Across the aisle, Peggy Stillwell watched the madman and shuddered at the image of the violence he had inflicted on her daughter. After a few minutes of order, Judge Miller ordered Williamson brought in again. In the holding room, the guards had explained to Ron that his behavior was inappropriate for a judicial setting and that further outbursts would be dealt with sternly. But as they let him in, he began cursing Dennis Fritz as soon as he saw him. The judge sent him back to jail, cleared the courtroom of all spectators, and waited an hour. Back in the jail, the guards ramped up their warnings, but Ron didn't care. Bogus confessions were all too common in Pontotoc County, and he couldn't believe the cops had squeezed one out of Dennis Fritz. Ron was an innocent man, and determined not to be persecuted like Ward and Fontenot. If he could get his hands around Dennis's neck, he would shake out the truth. His third entry was identical to the first two. As he stepped into the courtroom, he yelled, "Fritz, we're going to settle this now! You and me is going to settle it!" Judge Miller interrupted him, but Ron didn't slow down. "Me and you is going to settle it!" he yelled at Dennis. "I ain't never killed nobody!" "Hold him there," Judge Miller said to the guards. "Mr. Williamson, any further outbursts of anger, this hearing will be conducted without your presence."
"That'll be fine with me," Ron shot back.
"Okay, you understand. I'd rather not be here. If you don't mind, I'd rather go back to my cell." "You wish to waive your right to be present in the preliminary hearing?"
"Yes, I do."
"Nobody's threatening or forcing you to do this. This is your own personal—"
"I'm threatening,"
Ron snapped, glaring at Dennis. "Has anybody threatened you? This is your own personal decision to waive your—"
"I said I'm threatening."
"Okay. You do not wish to appear at this hearing. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. You may take him back to the county jail. Court record will reflect that the defendant, Ronald K. Williamson, does waive his right to appearance in this courtroom due to his outbursts of anger and total disruption. And the court finds that this hearing cannot be conducted with his presence based on, to his current statements to this court and outbursts. Ron went to his cell, and the preliminary hearing proceeded. In 1956, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a case known as Bishop v. United States, ruled that the conviction of a mentally incompetent person was a denial of due process. Where doubt exists as to a person's mental competency, the failure to conduct a proper inquiry is a deprivation of his constitutional rights. After Ron Williamson had spent 2 months in jail, no one involved in his prosecution or defense had questioned his mental competency. The evidence was blatantly obvious. His medical history was extensive and readily available to the court. His rantings in jail, though somewhat regulated by the arbitrary dispensing of medications by his lawyer and his jailers, were clear warnings. His reputation in Ada was well known, especially to the police. And his behavior in court had been seen before. 2 years earlier, when the state attempted to revoke Ron's suspended sentence on the escape charge, he so completely disrupted the hearing that he was sent to a mental hospital for evaluation. Presiding then was John David Miller, the same Judge Miller who was now holding the preliminary hearing. It was Judge Miller who had adjudicated him to be mentally incompetent at that time. Now, 2 years later, and with the death penalty at issue, Judge Miller evidently saw no need to inquire into Ron's state of mind. Oklahoma had a statute that allowed a judge, including one presiding over a preliminary hearing, to suspend the proceedings if the competency of a defendant became an issue. No motion from the defense was required. Most trial lawyers would argue strenuously that their client had a history of mental problems and should be evaluated. But absent such a plea, it remained the judge's duty to protect the constitutional rights of the defendant. The silence of Judge Miller should have been shattered by Barney Ward. As defense counsel, he could have requested a complete psychological evaluation of his client. The next step would have been to seek a competency hearing, the same routine procedure David Morris had pursued 2 years earlier. A final step would have been an insanity defense. With Ron out of the courtroom, the preliminary hearing proceeded quietly and in order. It ran for several days, and Ron never left his cell. Whether he was competent enough to assist in his own defense made little difference. Dr. Fred Jordan testified first and went through the autopsy and the cause of death, asphyxiation by either the belt around the neck or the washcloth stuffed in the mouth, or probably both. The lying began with the second witness, Glenn Gore, who testified that on the night of December 7th, he was at the coach light with some friends, one of whom was Debbie Carter, a girl he'd gone to school with and had known most of his life. At some point during the night, she asked Gore to save her or to rescue her because Ron Williamson was there too, and he was pestering her. He did not see Dennis Fritz at the coach light on December 7th. Under cross-examination, Gore said he told the police about this on December 8th, but their report of his interview does not mention Ron Williamson, nor was their report submitted to the defense as required by the rules of procedure. Thus, Glenn Gore became the only witness with direct evidence against Ron Williamson. By placing him in contact and in conflict with Debbie Carter just hours before her murder, he, technically, established the link between the murderer and his victim. All other evidence was circumstantial. Only a prosecutor as determined as Bill Peterson would be brazen enough to allow a criminal like Glenn Gore anywhere near his case. Gore had been brought to the preliminary hearing in cuffs and chains. He was serving a 40-year prison sentence for breaking and entering, kidnapping, and attempting to kill a police officer. 5 months earlier, Gore had broken into the home of his former wife, Gwen, and taken her hostage, along with his young daughter. He was drunk and for 5 hours held them at gunpoint. When a policeman, Rick Carson, glanced through a window, Gore aimed, fired, and hit Carson in the face. Fortunately, the injuries were not serious. Before sobering up and surrendering, Gore also shot at another police officer. It was not his first violent altercation with Gwen. In 1986, during the unraveling of their rocky marriage, Gore was charged with breaking into Gwen's house and stabbing her repeatedly with a butcher knife. She survived and pressed charges, and Gore faced two counts of first-degree burglary and one count of assault and battery with a dangerous weapon. 2 months earlier, he'd been charged for assaulting Gwen by choking her. In 1981, he'd been charged for forcibly entering the home of another woman. Gore also had an assault and battery charge from his army days and a long list of convictions for petty crimes. 1 week after his name was listed as an additional witness against Ron Williamson, a plea bargain agreement was filed. At the same time, one charge of kidnapping and one of assault with a dangerous weapon were dismissed. When Gore was sentenced, his ex-wife's parents filed a letter with the court in which they begged for a long prison sentence. It read, in part, "We want you to be aware of how dangerous we feel this man is. He intends to kill our daughter, granddaughter, and ourselves. This he has told us. We have gone to great lengths to make our daughter's home burglar-proof, but all failed. To go into detail all the times he has attacked her would make too lengthy a letter. Please give our daughter enough time to get the child raised before he is out of prison and the terror starts, so the little one never has to live through that again." For years, Barney Ward had suspected that Glenn Gore was involved in the Carter murder. He was a career criminal with a history of violence against women, and he was the last person seen with the victim. It was incomprehensible that the police showed so little interest in Gore. Gore's fingerprints were never submitted to the OSBI for analysis. Prints from a total of 44 people were submitted, but not Gore's. At one point, he agreed to take a polygraph exam, but one was never administered. The Ada police lost the first set of hair samples Gore gave them some 2 years after the murder. He then submitted another set, and perhaps another. No one could remember exactly. Barney, with his uncanny ability to hear and remember the courthouse gossip, firmly believed that Gore should have been investigated by the police. And he knew that his boy, Ronnie Williamson, was not guilty. The Gore mystery was partially explained 14 years after the preliminary hearing. Glenn Gore, still in prison, signed an affidavit in which he stated that during the early 1980s, he was selling drugs in Ada. He mentioned methamphetamine. Some of his transactions involved Ada policemen, specifically one Dennis Corvin, whom Gore described as a primary supplier and who frequented Harold's Club, where Gore worked. When Gore owed them money, they would arrest him under false pretenses, but for the most part, the cops left him alone. Under oath, he said in his affidavit, "However, most of the time during the early 1980s, I was aware that I was receiving favorable treatment from Ada law enforcement because I was involved in drug transactions with them. And this favorable treatment ended when I was no longer involved in the drug business with Ada police." He blamed his 40-year prison sentence on the fact that he was no longer selling drugs to the Ada police. Regarding Williamson, Gore said in 2001, he did not know if Ron was at the coach light the night of the murder. The police showed him a lineup of photos, pointed to Ron, and explained that he was the man they were interested in. Then they directly suggested that I identify Mr. Williamson. And, "To this day, I do not know if Ron Williamson was at the bar on the night that Debbie Carter disappeared. I made the identification because I knew the police expected me to do that." Gore's affidavit was prepared by an attorney, and it was reviewed by his own lawyer before he signed it. The state's next witness was Tommy Glover, a regular at the coach light and one of the last to see Debbie Carter. His initial recollection was that she was talking with Glenn Gore in the parking lot and that she pushed him away before driving off. But 4 years and 7 months later, he remembered things a bit differently. Glover testified at the preliminary hearing that he saw Gore speak to Debbie and that she got in her car and drove away, nothing more or less. Charlie Carter testified next and told the story of finding his daughter on the morning of December 8, 1982. OSBI agent Jerry Peters, a crime scene specialist, was called to the stand. It wasn't long before he was in trouble. Barney smelled a rat and grilled Peters on his conflicting opinions about the palm print on the sheetrock. A firm opinion in March 1983, then, surprise, an about-face in May 1987. What prompted Peters to rethink his original opinion that the palm print did not belong to Debbie Carter, Ron Williamson, or Dennis Fritz? Could it have been that this opinion didn't really help the prosecution? Peters did admit that nothing happened for 4 years, then a phone call early in 1987 from Bill Peterson prompted him to ponder his earlier judgment. After the exhumation and reprinting, he suddenly changed his mind and issued a report that was exactly what the prosecution wanted. Greg Saunders joined the assault on behalf of Dennis Fritz, and it was obvious the evidence had been reconstructed. But it was only a preliminary hearing, not a trial that required proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Peters also testified that of the 21 fingerprints found in the apartment and on the car, 19 belonged to Debbie Carter herself, one to Mike Carpenter, one to Dennis Smith, and none to either Fritz or Williamson. The prosecution's star was the amazing Terry Holland. From October 1984 to January 1985, Holland had been locked up in the Pontotoc County Jail for writing bad checks. As far as unsolved murders went in Oklahoma, it was a productive and remarkable four-month stay. First, she claimed she heard Carl Fontenot admit everything about the Denise Haraway kidnapping and murder. She testified in the first Ward Fontenot trial in September 1985 and gave the jury all the lurid details that Detective Smith and Rogers had furnished Tommy Ward during his dream confession. After she testified, she was given a light sentence on the check charges in spite of having two prior felonies. Ward and Fontenot went to death row. Terry Holland fled the county. She left behind some unpaid court fines and such, nothing the authorities would take seriously under normal circumstances, but they found her and brought her back anyway. Facing more charges, she suddenly had some astounding news for the investigators. When she was in jail hearing Fontenot's story, she also heard Ron Williamson make a full confession. What an amazing stroke of luck for the cops. Not only had they generated a dream confession, their favorite investigatory tool, but now they had another snitch, their second favorite weapon. Holland was vague on exactly why she had not told anyone about Ron's confession until sometime in the spring of 1987. Over 2 years had passed without a word. She was never asked why she rushed to tell Smith and Rogers about Fontenot's admissions. On the stand during the preliminary, she had a grand time with her fiction. With Ron absent from the proceedings, she was free to create all sorts of tales. She told of one episode in which he yelled into the phone at his mother and said, "I'll kill you just like I killed Debbie Carter." The only telephone in the jail was on a wall in the front office. On the rare occasions when inmates were allowed to make calls, they were forced to lean over a counter, stretch to get the receiver, and talk in the presence of whoever happened to be working the front desk. Eavesdropping by another inmate was unlikely, if not impossible. Terry Holland testified that Ron once made a phone call to a church, asked someone there for cigarettes, and threatened to burn down the place if they didn't bring him some. Again, no one could verify this statement. And she was not quizzed on the layout of the jail, and how exactly did a female prisoner get so close to the men. Peterson led her along. "Did he ever say anything that you overheard him say about what he had done to Debbie Carter?" "Yeah, he was talking in the bullpens," she answered. "It was right after they brought in Tommy Ward and Carl Fontenot." "What did he say in the bullpens in relationship to what he said he had done to Debbie Carter?"
"He just said that, I don't know how to say it. He said she thought she was better than he was and that he showed the bitch she wasn't."
"Anything else?"
"He said he made her make love to him, only that's not how he said it. I don't even remember how he said it. He said that he shoved a Coke ketchup bottle up her ass and her panties down her throat, and he taught her a lesson.
Bill Peterson plowed ahead with his leading questions. Did he say anything in relationship about Debbie should have come off of it or anything like that? Peterson asked.
Yeah, he'd try to go with her, and she didn't want nothing to do with him. And he said she'd been better off if she would just come off of it and give it to him.
And that he would not have had to do what?
Peterson asked, desperate to prompt his shaky witness.
Wouldn't have had to kill her.
It was remarkable that Bill Peterson, as an officer of the court and charged with the duty to seek the truth, could elicit such garbage. A crucial part of snitching is getting paid. Terry Holland was allowed to plea bargain herself out of trouble and out of jail. She agreed to a monthly payment plan for restitution, but soon abandoned her obligations. At the time, few people knew that Terry Holland had a history with Ron Williamson. Years earlier, when he was peddling Raleigh products around Ada, he stumbled upon a little unexpected sex. He knocked on a door, and a female voice asked him to step inside. When he did, a woman named Marlene Cutell presented herself completely in the nude. There appeared to be no one else at home, and one thing quickly led to another. Marlene Cutell was mentally unstable, and a week after the episode, she committed suicide. Ron returned several times to sell her more products, but never found her at home. He did not know she was dead. Her sister was Terry Holland. Shortly after the sexual encounter, Marlene told Terry about it and claimed Ron had raped her. No charges were brought. None were contemplated. Though Terry knew her sister was crazy, she still believed that Ron was responsible for Marlene's death. Ron had long since forgotten about the quickie and had no idea who Terry Holland was. The first day of the preliminary hearing dragged on with the laborious testimony of Dennis Smith, who described in detail the crime scene and the investigation. The only surprise came when Smith discussed the various writings left behind by the killers. The message on the wall scrawled in red fingernail polish, the "Don't look for us or else" in ketchup on the kitchen table, and the scarcely readable words on Debbie's stomach and back. Detectives Smith and Rogers thought such handwriting might be traceable, so 4 years earlier, they asked Dennis Fritz and Ron Williamson to write something on a white index card. The detectives had virtually no experience with handwriting analysis, but, not surprisingly, they felt strongly that they had a match. The samples given by Fritz and Williamson, words written in pen on an index card, looked suspiciously similar to the red fingernail polish message left on a wall and the smeared ketchup in the kitchen. They took their suspicions to some unidentified agent at the OSBI, and, according to Smith, this agent agreed and gave them a verbal confirmation. Under cross-examination from Greg Saunders, Smith testified, "Well, the handwriting, according to the person we talked to, was similar to the handwriting we found on the wall of the apartment. What about the table? Both of them were similar." A few minutes later, Barney grilled Smith on the handwriting analysis. He asked Smith if he had a report from the OSBI on Ron's handwriting.
"We did not submit it," Smith admitted.
Barney was incredulous. Why wasn't it submitted to the OSBI? They have the experts. Maybe they could have eliminated Ron and Dennis as suspects. Smith was on the defensive. "There were similarities in the handwriting, but, you know, it was based on our observations and nothing really scientific. I mean, we were, you know, we saw the similarities in it. But, you know, to compare two different types of writing like this is nearly an impossibility. You have writing with a brush, you have writing with a pencil, and that's two different types of writing." Barney replied, "Well now, you're not trying to tell this court that there's a possibility that these two boys, Dennis Fritz and Ronnie Williamson, took turns with that fingernail brush or fingernail polish brush and wrote a statement about Jim Smith and the other, you know, one of them wrote one letter and just alternated or anything of that nature which would give you the same conclusions, are you? No, but I think it was our opinion that both of them had a hand at the writing, not necessarily on the same writing, but, you know, there were several different writings in the apartment."
Though the handwriting testimony was offered at the preliminary to help prod the case along, it would prove too flimsy even for Bill Peterson to use at trial. At the end of the first day, Judge Miller was concerned about Ron's absence. At a bench conference, he expressed his worries to the lawyers.
I've done some reading about the absence of the defendant. I'm going to have Mr. Williamson brought back over about a quarter till nine and inquire one more time whether or not he still wishes not to be present. If he does, then he's going back again. To which Dr. Barney added helpfully, Do you want me to load him down with about 100 milligrams of...
I'm not telling you what to do, Judge Miller interrupted. At 8:45 the following morning, Ron was escorted into the courtroom. Judge Miller addressed him by saying, Mr. Williamson, yesterday you had expressed your desire not to be present during the preliminary hearing.
I don't want to even be up here, Ron said. I didn't have anything to do with this killing. I don't know who killed her. I don't know anything about it.
Okay. Your conduct and your disruptive behavior, you can reclaim your right to be present if you so desire. But you'll have to promise and be willing not to be disruptive and disorderly. And you'll have to do that in order to reclaim that right. Do you wish to be present?
No, I don't want to be here.
And you understand that you have the right to be here and listen to all the witnesses' testimony?
I don't want to be here. Whatever you all do, I can't help it. I'm tired of being crazy about this. It suffered me so much, I just don't want to be here.
Okay, and that's your decision. You do not wish to be present?
That's correct.
And you're waiving your right to confront witnesses by doing that, under the Constitution?
Yes, I am. You all can charge me on something I didn't do. You all can do anything you want to do.
Ron then looked at Gary Rogers and said, You scare me, Gary. You can charge me after 4.5 years of harassing me, sir.
You all can go at it because you all is the ones in control, not me.
Ron was taken back to jail, and the hearing resumed with the testimony of Dennis Smith. Gary Rogers followed with a tedious narrative of the investigation. Then OSBI agents Melvin Hett and Mary Long testified about the forensics involved in the case, fingerprints, hair analysis, and the components in blood and saliva. After the state rested its case, Barney called 10 witnesses, all jailers or former trustees. Not a one recalled hearing anything vaguely similar to what Terry Holland claimed she heard. When the testimony was over, Barney and Greg Saunders asked the court to dismiss the rape charges because they had not been brought within 3 years of the crime, as required by Oklahoma law. Murder has no statute of limitations, but all other crimes do. Judge Miller said he would rule on the motion at a later date. Almost lost in the shuffle was Dennis Fritz. The focus of Peterson's prosecution was obviously Ron Williamson and his star witnesses, Gore, Terry Holland, Gary Rogers with the dream confession, all testified against Ron. The only proof that remotely tied Fritz to the murder was the hair analysis testimony of Melvin Hett. Greg Saunders argued long and hard that the state had not met its burden of proving probable cause that Dennis Fritz was connected to the killing. Judge Miller took the matter under advisement. Barney joined in the fray with a noisy motion to dismiss all charges because of such light evidence, and Greg followed suit. When Judge Miller didn't issue a ruling immediately, when it became apparent he was actually considering the merits of the defense motions, the police and prosecutors realized they needed more evidence. Scientific experts carry great weight with juries, especially in small towns, and when the experts are employees of the state and called by the prosecution to testify against criminal defendants, their opinions are deemed infallible. Barney and Greg Saunders knew the hair and fingerprint testimony from the OSBI crowd was suspect, but they needed some help to dispute it. They would be allowed to cross-examine the state's experts and attempt to discredit them, but they also knew that lawyers rarely win such arguments. Experts are hard to pin down, and jurors are quickly confused. What the defense needed was an expert or two at its table. They filed a motion requesting such assistance. Such motions were commonly made but rarely granted. Experts cost money, and many local officials, including judges, cringed at the idea of forcing the taxpayers to cover the bill for an indigent defense that ran too high. The motion was argued. Left unsaid was the fact that Barney was blind. If anyone needed help in analyzing hair fibers and fingerprints, it was Barney Ward. Chapter 8. The paperwork flew back and forth. The DA's office amended the charges and dropped the rapes. The defense lawyers attacked the new indictment. Another hearing was needed. The district court judge was Ronald Jones from Pontotoc County, which, along with Seminole and Hughes, comprised the 22nd Judicial District. Judge Jones was elected in 1982 and, not surprisingly, was known to be pro-prosecution and tough on defendants. He believed strongly in the death penalty. He was a devout Christian, a Baptist deacon whose nicknames included Ron the Baptist and By the Book Jones. He did, though, have a weakness for jailhouse conversions, and some defense lawyers quietly advised their clients that a sudden interest in finding the Lord might prove beneficial when facing Judge Jones. On August 20th, Ron, unrepentant, was brought before him for an arraignment, the first time the two met in court. Judge Jones spoke to Ron and asked him how he was doing. He got an earful.
"I have one thing to say, sir," Ron began loudly. I feel strongly for the Carter family, as much as their kinfolks."
Judge Jones asked for silence. Ron continued,
"Sir, I know that you don't want... I didn't do this, sir."
The guards squeezed him, and he shut up. The arraignment was postponed so Judge Jones could review the transcript from the preliminary hearing. 2 weeks later, Ron was back with more motions by his lawyers. The jailers had fine-tuned the Thorazine. When Ron was in his cell and they wanted peace, they pumped him full and everybody was happy. But when he was scheduled to be in court, they reduced the dosage so he would appear louder, more intense, more belligerent. Norma Walker at Mental Health Services suspected the jailers reducing Ron and made a note in her file. The second appearance before Judge Jones did not go well. Ron was outspoken. He professed his innocence, claimed people were telling lies about him, and at one point said, "Mother knew I was at home that night." He was eventually returned to the jail, and the hearing continued. Barney Ward and Greg Saunders had requested separate trials, and they pressed hard on this issue. Saunders especially wanted his own jury without the baggage of a co-defendant like Ron Williamson. Judge Jones agreed and ordered separate trials. He also broached the issue of Ron's mental competency, telling Barney in court that the matter needed to be dealt with before the trial. Ron was finally arraigned, entered a formal plea of not guilty, and went back to jail. The Fritz case was now on a different track. Judge Jones had ordered a new preliminary hearing because the state had presented so little evidence against Dennis at the first one. The authorities didn't have enough witnesses. Normally, a prosecution with no hard evidence would worry the police, but not in Ada. No one panicked. The Pontotoc County Jail was full of potential snitches. The first one they found for Dennis Fritz was a career petty criminal named Cindy McIntosh. Dennis had been strategically moved to a cell closer to Ron so the two could talk. Their feud was over. Dennis had convinced him that he had not confessed. Cindy McIntosh claimed she got close enough to hear the two talk, then notified the police that she had the goods. According to McIntosh, Fritz and Williamson discussed some photographs submitted during the first preliminary hearing. Ron wasn't there, of course, and he was curious about what Dennis had seen. The photos were of the crime scene, and Ron asked Dennis, "Was she, Debbie Carter, on the bed or on the floor?" "The floor," Dennis replied. This, to the police, was clear proof that both men were in the apartment and committed the rape and murder. Bill Peterson was quickly convinced. On September 22nd, he filed a motion to add Cindy McIntosh as a witness for the state. The next snitch was James Riggins, though his career as such was short-lived. Hauled back from prison to face charges in Pontotoc County, Riggins was being returned to his cell one night when he passed another cell. Inside, he heard someone, perhaps Ron, admitting that he killed Debbie Carter, that he had 2 rape charges up in Tulsa, and that he would beat the murder rap just like he'd walked on the rapes. Riggins wasn't clear who Ron was doing all this confessing to, but in the snitching world, such details were not important. About a month later, Riggins changed his mind. In an interview with the police, he said he was incorrect about Ron Williamson, that in fact the man he heard doing the confessing was Glenn Gore. Confessions were contagious in Ada. On September 23rd, a young drug addict named Ricky Joe Simmons walked into the police department and announced he'd killed Debbie Carter and wanted to talk about it. Dennis Smith and Gary Rogers had no trouble locating a video recorder, and Simmons began his story. He admitted that he had abused drugs for years, his favorite being a homebrew called Crank, which included, among many ingredients, battery acid. He said he had finally kicked drugs, had found God, and had been reading his Bible one December night in 1982. He thought it was 1982, but wasn't sure. And for some strange reason began wandering around Ada on foot. He ran into a girl, presumably Debbie Carter, but he wasn't sure, and gave several conflicting versions of how he and the girl got together. He might have raped her, then maybe he didn't. And he thought he choked her to death with his hands, after which he prayed and vomited all over the apartment. Strange voices were telling him what to do. The details were a blur, and at one point Simmons said, "It seemed like a dream." Oddly, at this point, Smith and Rogers did not get excited over the prospect of yet another dream confession. When pressed on why he had waited almost 5 years to come forward, he was finally able to explain that all the recent gossip around town had led him to remember that fateful night back in 1982, or maybe it was 1981. But he couldn't recall how he entered Debbie's apartment, or how many rooms it had, or in which room he killed her. Then, suddenly, he remembered the ketchup bottle and scrawling words on the wall. Later, he said a friend at work had been talking about the details. Simmons claimed to be clean and sober during the confession, but it was obvious to Smith and Rogers that the crank had taken its toll. They dismissed his story immediately. Though it had as many inaccuracies as Tommy Ward's, the detectives were not impressed. Smith finally heard enough and announced, "In my opinion, you didn't kill Debbie Carter." Then he offered to get counseling for Simmons. Simmons, confused even further, insisted that he had killed her. The two detectives insisted he had not. They thanked him for his time and sent him away. Good news was rare at the Pontotoc County Jail, but early in November, Ron received an unexpected letter. An administrative law judge awarded him disability benefits under the Social Security Act. A year earlier, Annette applied for the benefits on Ron's behalf, claiming that he had been unable to work since 1979. The judge, Howard O'Brien, reviewed the extensive medical history and ordered a full hearing on October 26, 1987. Ron was driven over from the jail. In his decision, Judge O'Brien noted, "Clearly, the claimant has adequate medical documentation to show a history of alcoholism, depression that was stabilized with lithium, and has been classified as having an atypical bipolar disorder, complicated by an atypical personality disorder, probably borderline, paranoid, and antisocial. Clearly, without medications, he is belligerent, abusive, physically violent, has religious delusions, and a thought disorder. And there are repeated episodes of disorientation to time, impaired attention span, as well as impaired abstract thinking and level consciousness." Judge O'Brien had little trouble reaching his conclusion that Ron had severe bipolar disorder, personality disorder, and substance abuse disorder. Further, his condition was serious enough to prevent him from obtaining meaningful employment. Ron's period of disability began on March 31, 1985, and was continuing. The administrative law judge's primary job was to determine if claimants were disabled, either physically or mentally, and thus entitled to monthly benefits. These were important cases, but not life and death. Judges Miller and Jones, on the other hand, had a duty to ensure that every defendant, especially one facing death, received a fair trial. It was sadly ironic that Judge O'Brien could see Ron's obvious problems, while Judges Miller and Jones could not. Barney was concerned enough to have Ron evaluated. He arranged for testing at the Pontotoc County Health Department. The clinic director, Claudette Ray, administered a series of psychological tests and issued a report to Barney. It ended with, "Ron is consciously anxious due to situational stress. He feels helpless to alter his situation or better himself. He may behave inappropriately, such as not attending preliminary hearings which would benefit him, because of his panic and confused thinking. Most individuals would be demanding to hear information and opinions that would influence their future life or death." The report was tucked away in Barney's file and left there. A request for a competency hearing was a routine matter, one Barney had handled before. His client was sitting in jail, about 100 feet from the courthouse, a place Barney visited almost every day. The case was begging for someone to raise the issue of competency. The prosecution of Dennis Fritz got a huge boost from the testimony of a semi-literate Indian by the name of James C. Harjo. At 22, Harjo was already in jail for burglary. He got caught after he broke into the same home twice. In September and October, while he was awaiting transfer to a state prison, his cellmate was Dennis Fritz. The two became somewhat friendly. Dennis felt sorry for Harjo and wrote letters for the boy, most of them going to his wife. He also knew exactly what the cops had planned. Every other day they would pull Harjo out of the cell for no apparent reason. His court appearances were over. And as soon as he returned, he began quizzing Dennis about the Carter murder. In a jail full of accomplished snitches, Harjo had to be the worst. The scheme was so obvious that Dennis prepared a one-paragraph statement that he made Harjo sign every time the cops took him out. It read, in part, "Dennis Fritz always says he is innocent." And Dennis flatly refused to discuss the case with him. That didn't stop Harjo. On November 19th, Peterson listed James C. Harjo as a witness for the state. On that same date, the preliminary hearing for Dennis resumed before Judge John David Miller. When Peterson announced that his next witness would be Harjo, Dennis flinched. What could this stupid boy dream up? Harjo, under oath and lying badly, explained to an Ernest Bill Peterson that he had been cellmates with Fritz, and while at first things had been friendly, on Halloween night a conversation had turned ugly. Harjo was quizzing Dennis about the details of the murder. Dennis was having trouble with the details, and Harjo deftly managed to poke holes in his story. He became convinced that Dennis was guilty, so he confronted him. This made Dennis very nervous. He began pacing around the bullpen, obviously struggling with his guilt, and when he returned to their cell, he looked at Harjo with tears in his eyes and said, "We didn't mean to hurt her." In court, Dennis couldn't sit through this crap. He yelled at the witness, "You are lying! You are lying!" Judge Miller settled things down. Harjo and Peterson plowed ahead with their tales. In Harjo's account, Dennis expressed concern for his young daughter. "What would she think if her daddy was a murderer?" he asked. Then, some truly incredible testimony. Dennis confessed to Harjo that he and Ron had taken some beer to Debbie's apartment, and when they finished with the raping and killing, they picked up the empty cans, wiped down the apartment to remove their fingerprints, and left. On cross-examination, Greg Saunders asked Harjo if Dennis explained how he and Ron wiped off their invisible fingerprints while leaving dozens of others. Harjo had no clue. He admitted that there had been at least 6 other prisoners nearby when Dennis had made his confession Halloween night, but no one else heard it. Greg produced copies of the statements prepared by Dennis and signed by Harjo. Harjo was discredited when he took the oath, but after Saunders's cross-examination, he looked downright foolish. It didn't matter. Judge Miller had no choice but to bind Dennis over for trial. Under Oklahoma law, a judge at a preliminary hearing was not permitted to determine the credibility of a witness. Trial dates were set, then postponed. The winter of 1987-88 dragged on, with Ron and Dennis enduring life in jail and hoping their day in court would soon arrive. After months behind bars, they still believed in the possibility of justice and that the truth would be revealed. In the pre-trial skirmishing, the only significant victory for the defense had been the ruling by Judge Jones that they would be tried separately. Even though Bill Peterson had fought the motions for separate trials, there was a huge advantage in trying one before the other. Put Fritz on first, and let the newspaper report the details to an anxious and very curious town. Since the day of the murder, the police had insisted there were two killers, and the first and only pair they'd suspected had been Fritz and Williamson. At every step, suspicion, investigation, accusation, arrest, indictment, preliminary hearing, the two had been linked. Their mugshots were published side by side in the local paper. The headlines repeatedly read, "Williamson and Fritz." If Bill Peterson could get a conviction for Fritz in the first trial, the Williamson jurors would take their seats and start looking for a noose. In Ada, the notion of fairness was to try Fritz first, then follow immediately with Ron Williamson. Same courtroom, same judge, same witnesses, and the same newspaper reporting it all. On April 1st, 3 weeks before Ron's trial was to start, his court-appointed co-counsel, Frank Baber, filed a motion to withdraw from the case. Baber had found a job as a prosecutor in another district. Judge Jones granted the motion. Baber walked away. Barney was left with no assistance, no legal eyes to help sift through the documents, exhibits, photographs, and diagrams that would be introduced against his client. On April 6th, 1988, 5.5 years after the murder of Debbie Carter, Dennis Fritz was escorted into the crowded courtroom on the second floor of the Pontotoc County Courthouse. He was clean-shaven, with a fresh haircut, and he wore his only suit, one his mother had purchased for his trial. Wanda Fritz was sitting in the front row, as close to her son as possible. Seated next to her was her sister, Wilma Foss. They would not miss a single word of the trial. When the handcuffs were removed, Dennis glanced at the crowd and wondered which of the 100 or so potential jurors would eventually make it to the final 12. Which of those registered voters sitting out there would judge him? His long wait was over. After enduring 11 months in the suffocating jail, he was now in court. He had a good lawyer. He assumed the judge would guarantee a fair trial. 12 of his peers would carefully weigh the evidence and quickly realize that Peterson had no proof. The beginning of the trial was a relief, but it was also terrifying. It was, after all, Pontotoc County, and Dennis knew perfectly well that innocent people could be framed. He had briefly shared a cell with Carl Fontenot, a simple and confused soul who was now sitting on death row for a murder he had nothing to do with. Judge Jones entered and greeted the pool of jurors. Preliminary matters came first, then the jury selection began. It was a slow and tedious process. The hours dragged by as the aged, deaf, and sick were weeded out. Then the questions began, some by the lawyers, but most by Judge Jones. Greg Saunders and Bill Peterson haggled over which jurors to keep and which to strike. At one point in the lengthy process, Judge Jones asked the following question to a prospective juror by the name of Cecil Smith. "What was your past employment?" "Cecil Smith, the Oklahoma Corporation Commission." No follow-up questions were asked by the judge or the lawyers. What Cecil Smith failed to include in his abbreviated response was the fact that he'd had a long career in law enforcement. Moments later, Judge Jones asked Cecil Smith if he knew Detective Dennis Smith, or if he was related to him. Cecil Smith, "No kin." Judge Jones, "And how do you know him?" Cecil Smith, "I just know of him, and talked to him several times, had a few little deals with him, maybe." Hours later, a jury was sworn in. Of particular concern to Fritz was the presence of Cecil Smith. When he took his seat in the jury box, Smith gave Dennis a hard look, the first of many. The real trial began the following day. Nancy Shue, an assistant district attorney, outlined for the jury what the proof would be. Greg Saunders rebutted by saying in his opening statement that there was indeed very little proof. The first witness was Glenn Gore, who'd been brought back from prison. Gore, under direct examination from Peterson, presented the rather strange testimony that he did not see Dennis Fritz with Debbie Carter on the night of the murder. Most prosecutors prefer to start with a strong first witness who can put the killer in the same vicinity as the victim at about the same time of the murder. Peterson chose otherwise. Gore said he may have seen Dennis at the coach light at some undetermined point in the past, or perhaps he hadn't seen him there at all. The state's strategy became apparent with the first witness. Gore talked more about Ron Williamson than about Dennis Fritz, and Peterson asked more questions about Ron. The guilt by association scheme was put into play. Before Greg Saunders got the chance to impeach Gore on his lengthy criminal record, Peterson decided to discredit his own witness. He asked Gore about his criminal career. There were many convictions for crimes such as kidnapping, aggravated assault, and shooting a police officer. Not only did the state's prime witness fail to implicate Dennis, he was revealed to be a hardened felon serving a 40-year sentence. Off to a shaky start, Peterson continued with another witness who knew nothing. Tommy Glover described to the jury how he saw Debbie Carter talking to Glenn Gore before she went home from the coach light. After a quick appearance on the witness stand, Glover was dismissed without mentioning the name of Dennis Fritz. Gina Vieta told her story about the strange phone calls from Debbie in the early hours of December 8th. She also testified that she had seen Fritz at the coach light on several occasions, but not the night of the murder. Next, Charlie Carter told the heartbreaking story of finding his dead daughter. Then Detective Dennis Smith was called to the stand. Smith was led through the lengthy process of describing the murder scene and placing into evidence numerous photographs. He talked about the investigation he led, the collection of saliva and hair samples, and so on. Nancy Shue's first question about possible suspects was, not surprisingly, not about Dennis Fritz. "Did you interview a man then named Ronald Keith Williamson sometime during your investigation?" she asked. "Yes, we did." Smith, without interruption or objection, then rambled on about the police investigation into Ron Williamson and explained how and why he became a suspect. Finally, Nancy Shue remembered who was on trial and asked about a saliva sample from Dennis Fritz. Smith described how he collected the saliva and gave it to the OSBI lab in Oklahoma City. Shue finished the direct exam at that point and yielded the witness for cross. When she sat down, the state had provided no clue as to why and how Dennis Fritz became a suspect. He had no history with the victim. No one placed him remotely near her at the time of her murder, though Smith did testify that Fritz lived close to Debbie's apartment. There was no mention of motive. Fritz was finally linked to the murder through the testimony of Gary Rogers, the next witness, who said, "Through our investigation of Ron Williamson, that's when the defendant, Dennis Fritz's name, came into play as an associate of Ron Williamson." Rogers explained to the jury how he and Dennis Smith shrewdly concluded that such a crime had required two killers. The crime seemed too violent for just one man, plus the killers had left behind a clue when they wrote, in ketchup, "Don't look for us or else." The word "us" implied more than one killer, and Smith and Rogers were quick to pick up on this. Through good police work, they were able to learn that Williamson and Fritz had actually been friends. This, in their theory, linked the two killers. Greg Saunders had instructed Dennis to ignore the jury, but he found it impossible to do so. Those 12 people held his fate, maybe his life, in their hands, and he couldn't help but glance over occasionally. Cecil Smith sat in the front row, and whenever Dennis looked at the jury, Smith was always glaring back. What is his problem? Dennis thought. He soon found out. During a